listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight is part of a special interfaith series that is funded by the Righteous Persons Foundation, and we wanted to thank the Righteous Persons Foundation for their funding, and also we want to give special thanks to some of the partnering organizations who helped us spread the word on this, specifically the Muslim Public Affairs Council and the Progressive Jewish Alliance. And just want to welcome you here. There's more information about what the Library Foundation of Los Angeles does. It supports homework tutors for students all over Los Angeles. It makes 91 free Aloud programs possible, so please find out more about it and consider becoming a library associate. It is my great honor tonight to welcome our distinguished guests, Graham Fuller, Rabbi Reuben Firestone, and Dr. Mara Hatut. Graham Fuller's new book, A World Without Islam, is a fascinating read, as I think you'll find for yourself as you read it. As Reza Aslan says, it is a brilliant history lesson and a fascinating thought experiment. Fuller delves into religious and geopolitical history to help us understand how our Western perceptions of Islam were formed. And his analysis and arguments, we think, can help push our conversations about East-West relations beyond religious and ideological divides. And perhaps after tonight's program, some of us might reevaluate what we thought we knew about America's relationship to the Muslim world. And I'm going to abbreviate the bios for our three extraordinarily accomplished guests tonight. Graham Fuller is a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, in charge of long-range strategic forecasting. He is currently an independent writer, analyst, lecturer, and consultant on Muslim world affairs, and adjunct professor of history at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, and he is the author of numerous books on the Middle East. Dr. Mara Hatut is a leading spokesperson for the American Muslim community and has written extensively on Islam, human rights, democracy, Middle East politics, and Bosnia. In fact, one of our early programs here on Bosnia, we were very fortunate to have Dr. Hatut here. He is the senior advisor to the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and he frequently speaks about Islam and U.S. policy on Capitol Hill and at the U.S. Department of State. And we're very fortunate as our interlocutor tonight to have Rabbi Reuben Firestone. He has a PhD in Arabic and Islamic studies and is the author of numerous books. He's currently a professor of medieval Judaism and Islam at Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles and co-director of the Center for Muslim-Jewish Engagement, which is a joint program of Hebrew Union College, the Omar Ibn al-Khattab Foundation, and the Center for Religion and Civic Culture at the University of Southern California. We hope that if you enjoyed tonight's program, you'll also come back Thursday night for another one of our interfaith programs with Eliza Griswold and Amir Hussein, and then stay and join us for a reception after that, and we can talk about tonight as well. Now, please join me in welcoming our distinguished guests to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming. I'm glad everyone was able to brave the weather. Usually think of cold and rainy or snowy weather, not hot weather. Welcome. I have a very special relationship with both of my partners this evening that I really feel I need to call attention to, and that is the fact that we're just about the same size, usually about a foot and a half.
Thank you very much.
Beneath everybody else. So this is quite gratifying for me. My job is to begin the conversation among us and between us, and we will welcome you also to the conversation after I'm able to elicit some of the wisdom that Graham Fuller has written in this book. I should say from the get-go, it's a wonderful book. It is so stimulating. It's just a great read and forces one to kind of rethink a lot of assumptions that we have, and I hope you'll all pick up a copy and read it. And I get no commission for this particular book. I'm going to begin by reading a little piece of your book and asking you to respond to it. And I will perhaps do that periodically. I found one of the interesting aspects of the book is that you don't really deal with Islam for a while. You're dealing with other issues, and you kind of dance before you jab. You're in the subject, but you're providing a context for the subject, and that is of critical importance. Too often on the blogosphere, we receive, you know, the truth without any kind of contextualization. And of course, without context, there is no truth, because life is complex. So let me read to you one interesting piece that you wrote. And here it is. Deep roots of anti-Westernism still exist in the Orthodox Church. This is after a long explanation, an interesting explanation about Orthodox Christianity. What is more striking, many of these anti-Western feelings among the Eastern Orthodox strongly resemble certain Muslim attitudes toward the West as well, suggesting a common geopolitical source of shared views, suspicions, and grievances toward Western influence, intentions, and interventions. Fascinating. I'll take this moment for ask everyone to put your phasers on stun. I will do the same. Yeah. Okay, thank you. So let me just finish that last piece of it there. That the anti-Western feelings among the Eastern Orthodox strongly resemble certain Muslim attitudes toward the West as well, suggesting a common geopolitical source of shared views, suspicions, and grievances toward Western influence, intentions, and interventions. So here, this is seems like a strange statement at first glance. First of all, we might be surprised that Christianity could have anti-Western feelings. And second, your words suggest that Christian attitudes and Muslim attitudes toward the West might be quite similar. So I wonder if you could explain a little bit what you mean by this.
Sure. First of all, I think the major thesis of this book actually is that if there had been no Islam, no Prophet Muhammad, that essentially the relationship between the West and the Middle East would not be significantly different. I know it's a little bit of hyperbole there, but it's to make a significant point, I think. And what, as I look back in this historical period, I'm astonished to see, first of all, how much geopolitical tension existed before there was even Christianity, much less Islam, between East and West. When you look at the Persian Empire and the Greeks who were fighting back and forth over Anatolia for hundreds of years, both sides saw this very much as a kind of a civilizational thing. So, Reuven described as a kind of a dance is really a warm-up to suggesting that you can find the roots of this very early on. What is particularly striking is that by the time you have the Greek Orthodox Church, which came out of the Roman Empire, the Eastern Orthodox Empire based in Constantinople, you already had some geopolitical tensions with Rome as to who was going to be running things, who would be the ultimate authority, what territory they would have control over, who would get to convert whom. The rites were beginning to separate in slight ways. So, in effect, the early roots of fear and suspicion in the East, remember, these were Greek-speaking, this was a Greek-speaking culture as opposed to a Latin-speaking culture in Rome. The roots of suspicion were there already. I think we can argue that they were maybe picked up, absorbed when Islam began to absorb much of the same real estate. And with the collapse of the Byzantine Empire, the same ideas, suspicions of Rome moved up into Russia. And to this day, there are deep roots within Russia, within Eastern Orthodox civilization, of doubts about Western intentions, their way of life, their philosophy, and their aggressiveness. So I think there's a remarkable degree of historical continuity there that tells us something.
Yeah, I agree with the analysis. However, for that question to be complete, we should ask whether it is Christianity or Islam, could it be turned around whether the West has a confrontational attitude towards Christianity? Because when we talk about Christianity, we assume that Jesus was born in Paris or in New York, and then there is a problem with the with others. The reality is, particularly in America, that question should be brought up to service. Are people against us, or could it be us against the people? So that we close the circle. Your next book, God willing, you'll address that.
Yeah. So I'm hearing you saying that as the power in the Christian world shifted to the West, exactly. There was a move to kind of westernize Christianity or Europeanize what was really at roots a kind of Middle Eastern or Near Eastern religious tradition. It's a very interesting.
Exactly, and it's not really, it's important to understand, and I'm not trying to say in this book that Islam doesn't matter. Indeed, I have incredible respect for Islam and other religions as well as having deep spiritual powers in guiding life and providing comfort and direction and all of that. I am, however, in this book specifically looking at the problem of power and religion, and the state. And any state finds it very hard to keep its hands off religion because it wants to use it and manipulate it for its own ends. And that's part of the difficulty here was that Rome was using religion for its own ends, and so was the Eastern Orthodox Church. And then Islamic institutions and states came along and followed many of the same practices.
So the Eastern Orthodox world that used to be under the control of the Byzantine Christian Empire with the capital in Constantinople, which would encompass today, say, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, move across North Africa all the way to the west to Morocco.
And the Balkans.
Many of those areas, or most of those areas, came under Muslim control. So how did the church fare, and how did Christians fare in that transitional period?
Well, as you know, one of the good things about Islam coming late in the game was that it had the predecessors of both Judaism and Christianity and absorbed, as you know, and accepted huge amounts of these two faiths, accepting the prophet Moses, the prophet Jesus, as great parts of great features of later Islamic faith. So right away, there was no predisposition to downgrade, to denigrate these faiths, whereas if you came from, say, Judaism or Christianity, you were dealing with a brand new faith, and new faiths look heretical to older faiths invariably. So I think Islam had an advantage here in feeling comfortable with permitting large Jewish or Christian communities to exist and operate within them. Perhaps they were not fully first-class citizens in every sense, since they didn't serve in the military and had to pay a tax in lieu of serving in the military. But essentially, there was a great deal of harmony. That harmony, I think, began to be broken later on and indeed, the Orthodox Church at one point had become so suspicious of Western intentions when Rome, during the Crusades, in the Fourth Crusade, sent down huge armies in each of these, but didn't even bother to go to the Holy Land for the Fourth Crusade, stopped in Constantinople and just sacked it, pillaged it, killed hundreds of thousands of people, and imposed Roman Catholic Christianity on it for a period of some 50 years, which was just devastating to them. Now, that has never been forgotten by the Eastern Orthodox Church, and it is well known that when the Turks were beating at the doors of Constantinople to take this as the final last holdout of the Eastern Orthodox Empire, the clergy decided that they would rather fall to the Muslims than they would fall to Latin Christendom, because they knew from historical experience and historical evidence that they could survive as an Eastern Orthodox faith under Islam, whereas if it fell under Roman Catholicism, that would be the end of it, and they would all be Romanized, and it would be even the end of their own doctrinal practices and theology.
One last major jab before we move into the into the heavy duty stuff. I I was also intrigued. These are narratives or stories that we don't, let's put it this way. The story of the Fourth Crusade and the sacking of Constantinople is something that if you don't take the medieval history class in college or university, you don't learn about this. This is, Christian against Christian. There was another crusade, if you will, that you mentioned that I think is worth thinking about as well, because that also is not part of our narrative, and that is the Baltic Crusade or the Northern Crusade. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, because today we think, and okay, we're all, in a way, we're all on the same side. We're not going to be debating each other and trying to attack one another on this forum. This is an educational this is not a completely open forum here, the three of us. It's fair to, and I think in the interest of full disclosure, I think it's important to make the statement. But in the narrative that we hear today about Islam and the conquest and so-called forced conversions in Islam or the sword and these kinds of views, almost kind of romantic, strange Orientalist perspectives, I'm wondering if it might not come something from our own history, from our view of ourselves that's projected to the other. So I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about that Northern or Baltic Crusade before we move more fully into Islam.
Well, I even majored in history, and not even in Western history, particularly when I was at university. So actually it was in doing the research on this book that more and more of these facts came out that I found quite astonishing. But first of all, it's interesting. I mean, when you think of the Crusades, it's a quintessentially religious confrontation between Islam and Christianity. But then when you look at the political, the cultural, the economic setting of Western Europe at the time, and by the way, there was a little matter that Jerusalem had become had come under Muslim control some 500 years earlier, so it was only 500 years later that they were getting around to deciding that maybe they should have a crusade to go and liberate the Holy Land. But there were a lot of interesting other reasons. There were all kinds of youth. There was a youth bulge. The Black Plague had come to an end. And so the Pope didn't know what to do with all these people. They wanted to send them off to get, all these dangerous young people. History never changes. send them off on some foreign adventure. And so this was the particular calling. But one of those adventures was to send them off to the Baltics and to parts of the Slavic Empire, in many cases displacing German Christian communities that had not sufficiently come under Rome's control, and in other cases what we would call, or what they called, pagan influence, and it was very bloody indeed. And it was just today when Reuben and I were having coffee together, I do mention in the book that the Crusaders warmed up to go off on their crusades by going in and slaughtering Jews in Germany. But the extent to which that had happened, I had not fully realized. So Reuben, you might want to say a few words about that as well. Suggesting that this was equally fair discrimination on all sides.
Right. The First Crusade, which was called in 1095 and actually launched in 1096, there was a collection of various crusading groups in the Rhine Valley in 1096, in the spring and summer of 1096, before they were going to move across and to get to the Holy Land. And there was a large Jewish community there. And not all the Crusaders, but there were factions within the Crusaders who were just, I don't know, they were just high on testosterone or whatever the problems were. But they said, why are we wasting our time here when we have, we have infidels in our midst? Why, let's warm up and get ready. Why do we have to go all the way across the Mediterranean in order to kill the infidels and to shoot and destroy them? So let's make the Jews into Christians or kill them. And the actual percentage of the Jewish population killed in the First Crusade in 1096 is actually greater, I understand, than the percentage of the Jewish community of Europe killed in the Holocaust. So it was a horrendous, horrendous destruction of the Jewish communities there.
Yeah, and the same question came up as the Crusaders began to get down towards Constantinople, because there was a real question about whether these were really proper Christians as well. The Pope, to his credit, there was a lot that was wrong, but the Pope, to his credit, by the time of the Fourth Crusade, said, no, no, they may not agree with this in all theological issues, but they are Christian and they should not be killed. But they indeed were killed. But taking out this religious element, what's really quite astonishing about these crusades, well, I should say more than that, the great schism between Eastern and Western churches in the 11th century, these were two huge empires, Rome on the one side, Christian Empire, and the Eastern Orthodox Byzantine. They had a falling out over an issue, and this was really abstruse. Some of you may know about it. The discussion was whether the Holy Spirit, which is already not a crystal clear concept, whether the Holy Spirit is descended from God the Father only, or whether the Holy Spirit is descended from the God the Father and God the Son simultaneously. This was the point at which these two huge empires were just torn asunder, sworn enemies declared each other anathema at that point. It was the contemporary equivalent of takfir, I guess we might say. But what it makes you realize here is that something else is going on. It's like if you visit some friends and the husband and wife have a screaming match at the dinner party and throw crockery at each other over whether the pasta is properly cooked or not. You know something else is going on here. And with this case, when it was whether the Holy Spirit is descended from the Father or the Father and the Son jointly, you know that there were a lot of other tensions that were not really about theology at all. And that to me says a lot.
Yeah, there are similar parallels in Islamic history, because at a certain time during Al-Ma'mun, there was that whole quarrel about whether Quran is created or is it eternal. And they fought each other, they killed each other, they imprisoned great scholars, and nobody bothered to say what is the difference. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you want to follow the instructions in this book or not. But they got cornered into that side fight. So this is in support of the theory of your book, that there is something else. Of course, there was at that time the rationalists versus the traditionalists, and the Mu'tazilites, who are the thinkers, versus those who are the imitators or whatever, or the Puritans. And this had political consequences par excellence, because if you follow that rational school, you will challenge the authority, because the authority was illegitimate. And this seeped on even in Islamic jurisprudence, is whether a man can marry a woman if she is not full aware of the contract or not. And of course, there is one group said marriage happened, maybe it is not, as they call it, aqd fasid, means it is not a sound contract, yet it is a contract. And while the other people said no, the agreement and the consent and the acceptance of the woman is crucial to make the contract a contract. Mm-hmm. So it is not only in Christianity, I think it is in the exchange of powers in the human society that somehow brilliantly could use religion to push certain agendas, which is happening, of course, unfortunately, up till now.
Yeah, and if I could add here, Reuven, I don't want to, you may want to talk about this point later on down the road, but I just want to say, these are fascinating issues, but this book hopefully is more than just an interesting examination of weird things you didn't know about history. I think this has extremely important consequences, because if we say that yes, the struggle between East and West really is about Islam, then the consequences are one set of directions, some of which we're familiar with. If you say no, it's extremely complicated, and actually it isn't religion at all, but all kinds of other issues going on, then your question about how do we deal with terrorism, or how do we treat the Middle East and all of these things, will follow an entirely different course. So this is not just an exercise in clever rewriting of history at all.
Yeah, so we have begun our discussion with some Christianity bashing, right? Sort of unveiling some of the underside, the dark side.
I'm not part of that.
No, right? We had the...
This is perfectly Judeo-Christian.
Yeah. And then we had Dr. Hatut doing what we Jews did a week and a half ago, which is we say, we have sinned before you, Ashamnu Bagadnu, of saying that in Islam we also have, we've had something that might be viewed in, I guess, psychological terminology as the presenting problem. The presenting problem is you don't get the theology right. You don't understand what the truth is, but the presenting problem is really hiding something that is far beyond the broken dishes, something far more basic and far more important. So I think we need to not fall in, and I don't think we're doing this, but we have to be careful not to fall into the atheist anti-religion entire bashing perspective, which is that all religions are bad because they're all absolutist and they hide political machinations under the guise of morality, and so religion is bad. But religion does have something to do with the complexity of the situation. And I wonder if we could begin to unpack some of that, because I think we would all agree religion is not the problem. The problem is far more complex. But religion is, just by the fact that it's invoked by so many parties, it makes it, in a way, part of the problem. And religion, whether it's Christianity in that period of time, the religion du jour of bashing today is Islam, or whether it's Judaism as a kind of revival of militancy in Israel-Palestinian conflict. How does that... Can you give us some ideas about how that fits into that complex network and puzzle that is the Middle East today?
Well, religion is too important a subject to be left alone by the state. I mean, these are issues that talk about life, about death, about the meaning of life, the purpose of life, sexuality, morality, has huge hold over people for very legitimate reasons. So the state often does not want to let go, allow these forces to run independently. So every state, I think, in a way, tries to bring this under its control, either to absorb it. Christianity did this. I know less about the history of Judaism, but of course, the Jewish state did not dominate very strongly in history compared to either in Islam or Christianity. So maybe it had less of a chance to happen, but I'd welcome your comment on that. But anyway, so the state can't really leave this alone, and essentially seeks to control or direct. But, you can't be naked. A state cannot be naked and saying, I want your oil, I want your territory, I want you, I want to recruit these people to my church, not to your church. So you try to find higher cause, a higher philosophical banner. Everybody does this, even the most horrendous movements. Nazism was in the name of, some master race that would succeed, or Marxism and Lenin. Stalin was happily able to kill 20 million people in the name of the future of the proletariat and the working class. So people seek high banners, hot flags under which to justify these things. Now, sadly, if the flag is used enough times, people can become confused to think it is all about the flag. The particular flag involved. And today, with communications the way they are, and internet and television and everything else, it can seem at times that Islam is really what the issue is all about, because that's the terms in which not only some Christians... I mean, if you took some really hardline Christians, Jews, and Muslims, they would all absolutely agree that it's all about religion and eternal struggle among these things. That they love that because it gives credence and strength to their own faith. But I would argue that other than these hardline views on any of them, people are aware that something else is going on, that the state may be manipulating to its own end.
I think the most efficient state usually is able to control the machine, the police and armed forces and the bureaucracy, etc., but cannot control the feelings and the minds of people except through propaganda again and the brainwash. Religion controls the minds and the hearts of people. And so the state will be so keen, so hungry to engulf religion, to get religion on its side, because this is their only guarantee to subdue the masses. And I don't fault Marx when he said it is the opium of the masses, talking from a rebellious side of the equation. But really, religion can be used as an opium to subdue the masses if religion is strongly married to the authority. And I wonder how people who are sincere in their religiosity are not very aware of that. So the even rush, we want to have legislation from religion. We have to want to have religious people to run the show. We want to have the mullahs in power while they are digging their own grave and the grave of religion, because the state has no interest but to maintain its power. And any organized other power will be crushed eventually. I can digress to say that I hope that the only hope is kind of egalitarian democracy dealing with religion, like the promise of the American experiment. This is why we are so concerned about this American experiment if it fails. I think that will be of disastrous consequences all over the world.
I wonder, this is an interesting observation. I wonder if you could, either of you gentlemen, could comment on the notion of a religious democracy. You know, we have a viewpoint in this country that there must be an absolute separation of church and state. In France, the state controls the church, but it's not a separation exactly. And in Turkey today, for example, we were just mentioning before the show, just chatting a little bit about this fascinating experiment that's occurring in Turkey, where Turkey, the state of Turkey, is becoming increasingly democratic and increasingly religious, or Islamic, if you will. And that's pushing a lot of red buttons and sounding a lot of alarms in the West. I wonder how you would respond to that. Let's start with Graham, since you haven't said anything for a moment.
Well, it's a fascinating question. I think all states, in a way, are presented with the dilemma of how much should we legislate morality? I mean, we've seen this in the American prohibition, at least in the prohibition. It comes up with questions of abortion today, which is clearly a deeply worrisome moral issue. But many people feel it should be so sufficiently important that the state should legislate, others not. I was really quite fascinated, and I can't remember whether it's in the book or not, but I was talking with a Turkish Islamist some years ago who told me that initially they had thought that it was very important for the state, it was important for Islamists, those who believe that Islam has something important to say about legislation and society in general terms. He said that many of these Islamist parties, including in Turkey, had thought perhaps the state should use some of its legislative power to impose certain kinds of laws. I mean, after all, we say you can't murder people or you can't marry a 10-year-old girl. That's the state imposing itself on morality already. Or you can't drink till you're 21 or 18, or whatever. That's imposing yourself on morality. But so this guy was saying, we have come to believe that this is not very helpful and it could be very dangerous. And he used a phrase that I love. He said, people basically should have the freedom to sin. That it's not the state's business to keep you from sinning. And furthermore, he said that the gates of hell should be open to anybody who knocks at them. This is a very enlightened view in many respects, and I wonder whether some Islamist movements may decide that indeed it's the better part to maybe preach certain types of values if they want, but that you can't force, you can't close the gates of hell by force.
I come from a perspective, admittedly, so Quranic perspective. And as you notice, I didn't say Islamic perspective, because Islamic will be colored by what Muslims are doing, which is sometimes is the antithesis of what my humble being understands from the Quran. A Quranic perspective is very clear that the collectivity should interfere if harm is done to others. Short of that, you want to be a Muslim, or you want to be a non-Muslim, or a kafir, or you want to drink in the privacy of your home, if you want to, if you commit the sin, but not in public to be witnessed by four witnesses, seeing the full act, this is where I interfere, not as a spiritual exercise, but to maintain some law and order so that we can all live together without bumping each other. So that's my understanding of the Quranic directives. The way it translated when religion was married to authority, and unfortunately this happened early on, is that that equation was tilted, that I will tell you what to do because I know what God wants you to do, and who you think you are, you think you understand better than God. The same thing it happened in all other religions. Like, I'll show you the light. Even if you are blind, I'll open your eyes and show you the light. And I will save your soul. Leave my soul alone. Exactly. If the soul wants to knock on the door of hell, why are you delaying me? So it really depends on... we need a paradigm shift in handling the resources. And to the further we go away, the further we depart from the exercises of political structures and power structures to the essence and the pure guidance of Almighty, the more we will be in a much, much better situation than we are.
So that's interesting. So what I'm hearing from you, and I think that this is going to elicit a response, is that...
I hope not.
is that if we were to apply this to Turkey today, the experiment is maybe not the right way to go. Here we have an Islamic, a self-identifying party that identifies itself as a religious Islamic party. Not a radical party, but a religious Islam. I mean, what does radical mean? The oppositions, are saying it's a radical party. The party itself doesn't say it's a radical party. That's not the way to go in Turkey? Do you think, so is there a possibility, say in Turkey, all other things being equal, that there really should be an absolute separation of political powers from religious powers? Or is there a way in which a culture which is different than an American or Western European culture can have an Islamic democracy? And if there is, what might that mean?
This point is subtle, but extremely important, because I'm like Turkey, personally. I am committed to Islam. I am a Muslim who is very proud to be a Muslim and committed to Islam, and I believe that Islam is good. Nonetheless, the actualization of Islam, the mechanics of actualizing Islam in life, is where you can go the Saudi way of having religious police and they beat you if you don't go to prayer, or if, God forbid, the piece of the cloth is blown away or whatever, versus the Turkish example, which he says, if people choose Islam, they should express this choice in a democratic one man, one vote election and in a legislative body that is not formalized out of the theologians. Mm-hmm. It is for people who are leading the people to prevent harm and to bring benefits to this life. So whether we wanted to call it an Islamic or not Islamic, I lost the fascination with the titles and the labels long time ago. But in essence, to me, that's Islamic, because Islam is not to impose the will of a group of people, whether they are the theologians or the ulama or the clergy or the military, needless to say, on the people, because they know better than them. It is the antithesis of our entrance to Islam, which is La ilaha illallah, which literally means there is no authority to be submitted to but God. Here at that very crux of the matter, at the very heart of the issue, we killed authoritarianism. But whether it happened or not, it did not.
Well, and this brings us back again to the theme of the book, namely how much of this is about religion and how much of it is about something else. It is, I think, very dangerous today that many of these movements are speaking in the name of Islam, or have in the past in the name of other religions, or any ideology for that matter. When it's mixed, when you combine absolute certitude, even with an atheist ideology such as Marxism, with power, you're getting into a dangerous situation. But I think many Muslims are not reacting to the world situation because of theology, but simply because of deep grievance or anger at events that are happening, and are moved to strike back, if you will, in response, and not on the basis of theology.
So I'd like to turn the discussion a little bit there. I have another great question that really came from your book. I have to ask the question, but I won't let you answer it. The question is, this means you have to read the book. The question is, based on an observation that you made in the book, that when you have a totalitarian religious system, you have religion under control of an authority, the church or the power. Right, it could be Jewish, could be Muslim, could be Jewish, Christian. In a more democratic religious system, you don't have the dogma police making sure that people are in line. So you have a lot of individual input in how they understand their place in the world, the divinity, spirituality, relations with other human beings, and such. And that's really a very dangerous thing, because you allow real crazies to blossom and flourish, particularly if times are difficult. And that creates not necessarily such a good thing. We think of democratizing religion as a good thing. Let us get into it ourselves, but it can be extremely dangerous and has been proven to be so in history. I would love to hear your response, but I'm not going to ask for it at this moment.
I won't answer them.
We don't have a lot of time before we open it up for questions. And in an earlier discussion just now, before we began the show, you mentioned something interesting about the Muslim community and the ability of America to absorb the Muslim immigration in America in relationship as opposed to, let's say, the European situation, which is a much more difficult situation. You said something very interesting. You said, I'm less worried about the future of Islam with regard to the ability of America to absorb Muslim immigrants and to have them be fully Muslim and fully involved in civic society of America than I am about American intervention and causing destabilization in other parts of the world, and how are we ever going to stop that? So I wonder if you could respond to
that. Well, I mean, like everybody, I think we're all dismayed at the latest demonstration of intolerance, which at this point happens to be Islam. And certainly when we look at the events of 9/11, we understand where some of this is coming from, although a key thesis of the book, and I won't elaborate on at this point, is that history did not begin with 9/11, although we think it did in this country. So essentially, I have, when you look at American history and look at the trouble that other immigrants have had, and I'm sitting between two people who have experienced this directly in a way that I have not or are closer to it, discrimination against any kind of ethnic group, religious group, Jews, Muslims, Catholics at some point. There was a very serious issue over Catholics, and I'm old enough to remember serious questions about whether John F. Kennedy was fit to be president because he was going to be Catholic, prejudice against Italians and Irish, and, you know, not even people from far continents, but from Western Europe as to their appropriate. So I do have confidence, I think, looking back in history, that eventually we will get through it in a way maybe better than most other societies in this world have managed to do, maybe because we are so much an immigrant society. Canada, certainly, equally well. Australia, as again, immigrant societies. So I think we can get past this, and there's an awareness on the part of many Americans. But when I look at the present character of American foreign policy, which is still, in my view, on a missionary impulse. It's very much a glorying in America as the world's sole superpower, the world's policeman, America as an exceptional nation with an exceptional mission, which took 9/11, the outrage of 9/11. And managed to, by certain at least political and ideological elements, to parlay this into genuine American empire. And I know that word is disturbing to many Americans and has been to me in the past, but many have embraced this term, actually, among some of the neoconservative thinkers and others, saying, yes, it is, and it is a different kind of empire, but it's an American empire, and it's going to be the 21st century is the American century. So I worry when those sets of ideas that we can go anywhere, do anything, impose our own realities through military, economic, and political force, that we are then creating tremendous opposition, and especially in the Muslim world where the most American boots are on the ground and kicking down doors and spending, Joseph Stiglitz of former IMF said, up to $3 trillion on this failing and disastrously conceived operation. Turning that around, especially when you have a president that would seemingly be disinclined to go that route as opposed to George W. Bush before him, and has immense problems in trying to turn this somewhat imperial supertanker around, that is when I really get worried, and I wonder what it would take to change that, except short of going broke in the process of trying to do it, which, God forbid, will not happen.
Bob, you may have heard Bob Woodward's new book addresses this issue very interestingly. And the name is?
Obama Wars.
Yes, Obama. Probably, you know, very, very interesting. I wonder, Dr. Hatoud, how you, as an Egyptian originally, who came from Egypt and has experienced Egypt in various regimes and is clearly an Egypt watcher, I know from our conversations, I wonder if you would have some comment about the relationship between the United States and its policy vis-a-vis Egypt today, if you have anything you'd like to say about that.
This is a very interesting case study. I think the State Department should understand the history of American-Egyptian relationship. Because when I was young, or the generation that was younger than me, we were raised up on Wilson declarations to oppose the British occupation. And to us, America was perceived as the beacon that the good model of the American Revolution and its literature and its slogans, and give me liberty or give me death, etc. That was what motivating us to stand up to an enormous, horrible empire like the British Empire at that time. Then we find the other face of America gradually emerging, and it was not the pretty face that we were fascinated with before it became clear. It became very clear for people who are probably politically savvy when America did not really oppose clearly the British occupation to Egypt. Then it became clearer on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, where every American president started his inauguration by pledging allegiance to Israel, not to America, I mean, to America later on, and by consistently taking a blind support. Support I can understand for so many reasons. And probably if I am a decision maker, probably I would have considered some of the things. But blind support is what is very disturbing, because it's telling me no matter what you do, you are bad. No matter what they do, they are good. And this is not, is not conducive of good feeling. Nonetheless, up till this moment, America, the culture, America, the people, America, the science, the research, the medicine, the movie, and art is still an aspiration to lots of Egyptians and Arabs in that matter. But American foreign policy, I am glad that you said what you said. You know, I envy you, because you say things that if I say, I might be in one of these black holes somewhere. You are, I'm sure you know nice people in nice places. So...
CIA background doesn't hurt anywhere.
I find I have to cling to my CIA background, because otherwise I might be viewed as another long-haired professor from UCLA or something.
Yeah, nonetheless,
there's always the born problem.
You are a man of great integrity, but not everybody can afford integrity. Definitely, we are very jeopardized when we speak with integrity about things that our fellow citizens speak about lucidly and easily and in a very relaxed way. And this should bring part of our discussion here tonight, the power of intimidation in America and how it is obfuscating the emergence of a guided, informed discourse or debate.
You want to respond to that, John?
Well, I just feel that coming back to the foreign policy issues again, that this is a highly corrosive and corrupting influence on American life. I'm a deep believer. I obviously grew up in this country in so many important values that suddenly when you start working overseas for years and year after year after year, you begin to find you don't find reflected in those. Maybe we think when we sit back here, we think we're reflecting them, but I find it highly corrosive, because it means, again, militarization of foreign policy, the need to control the press so that the wars look good and that the wars are justified, and truth takes a heavy toll under these circumstances, and we're going broke in the process while making tons of enemies. And for every bad guy that we think we are able to get rid of, more are being recruited daily. So I view this policy as leading really in many ways towards the ruination of an extraordinary country and an extraordinary streak of idealism that Maharet had referred to as stimulating other people in other countries in the past.
Well, I think with that very bland remark, that might be a great opportunity to open up the floor for questions. So we have two people with microphones. I think the gentleman in the front was the first one to raise his hand, and let's I'll take it from there. So let's...
I'd like to propound a thesis and ask for a response. Judaism had Christ, Hinduism had Buddha. After 1,500 years came the Reformation. But Islam, it seems to me, has been seamless for the last nearly 1,400 years. Is there any possibility that there may come a change in Islam the same way that things happened with Hinduism and with Judaism and with Christianity?
I guess the question is to you.
I'll start, but no,
you sound like the
you
most
know
Muslim
more
guy in the...
Look, this is exactly the crux of the issue, is that how is it that religions change and evolve? I hesitate to say modernize because that makes it sound always for the better, but evolve. And you're right, other religions have evolved, but for that matter, and I want very much to hear Dr. Hatoud's remarks on this. I think Islam has been adjusting to the world. I think my book in part talks about this, adjusting to different civilizations and cultures over time. But I think, yes, under conditions of imperialism, and I'm not talking about the United States here so much as I am several hundred years of European control in which Islamic institutions were essentially suppressed and removed from positions of authority. I think the process of evolution was hindered very much. But certainly every Muslim who lives anywhere is experiencing a different kind of Islam, a different range of questions. So very exciting questions, I think, are being raised now. Actually, you have to go back 100 years to some of the real beginnings of this, probably earlier, but especially to the early 20th century. Exactly. Where the Muslims were very disturbed about the questions of why the West is so powerful, what is it that they're doing right that we're not doing right, and why, how Islam is going to live next door to a variety of Western experiences and power. I think there were many answers then. There's still many answers given to today. It is a dynamic movement, but boy, there's nothing like war and oppression and to freeze thinking. I mean, any culture that comes heavily under the gun is going to retreat to the most fundamentalist views of this is just classic sociology, essentially. It's going to retreat to that. So I'm afraid that you wouldn't look to Judaism under at the time of the Holocaust, or Christian communities threatened by any other kind of community in the world, or to Muslims under the gun, literally, today, to find very open, comfortable, you know, liberal thinking. I fear that it's these conditions are creating and stimulating and strengthening the most radical forces under conditions of war and occupation, and what you do about that.
I think, number one, I agree, besieged communities don't have the luxury of thinking abstract. They're usually very busy defending their very mere existence. However, the question of the gentleman was, when are we going to see Islam change like Christianity and Judaism? I hope it doesn't, because what is left of Christianity and Judaism, I don't know. What is left, actually? It is relativism, that it is very difficult for lots of people who study religion like myself with fascination of Christianity and Judaism to trace things and to say that will... we all Christians will agree upon to make you a Christian who is not heretic and who is accepted. Nonetheless, the development of progressive thought within Islam, that is what is needed. The method of actualizing Islam in our life in a very progressive way, coping with modernity, that is the question. It's not to change Islam, because I don't want to change Islam. I want... because I am happy with it, to be honest with you, giving comfort to my heart, making sense to my mind, and very proud of its history. Why do I want to change it? Because some people in America wanted to say, oh, they went through the Reformation? No. But the way that the thoughts of Muslims have been stagnating and leading them to clash with everybody else, or to play the victims or the superior, is a very dangerous way. And they will fall in the pit of irrelevance as far as human civilization is concerned. That process of development of progressive, modernized Islamic thought definitely has been blocked and obstructed and sometimes aborted by very heavy-handed forces coming not from internal, but coming from external powers that felt that Islam, even as it is, which is not progressive formula, is danger to their interests. So they wanted to, and that's what made Muslims very doubtful. Every Muslim now, every progressive Muslim understands that the gender relationships, the way it is practiced in some Muslim countries, is draconian and archaic and patriarchal and tribal and is not Islamic. Nonetheless, when Bill Abzug or John Fundat go to tell them that, they resent it. Go and mind your own business. After all, you didn't even have equal salaries here, equal payment for men and women, or we have more parliament members in Iran than in the Congress. So it creates an attitude of resentment. I think the development of progressive Islamic thought should be within the Muslim circles, and I can say boldly that it has to start outside the Muslim world, and I think it can only start in the United States for reasons comparing United States to Europe.
By Muslims.
By Muslims, oh yeah. By Muslims, by the impacts, the Islamic Center, the Tariq Ramadans, the Fatih Osman, God bless his soul. Those are the pioneers of progress that they understand Islam as a higher level other than the tribe of Muslims.
Yeah, and I'll just add one cent worth here, in that the apparently some one-third of the Muslim world is living outside of Muslim-majority countries. And that's a very large community of people who are living in multicultural, multi-religious, pluralistic, and many of them pluralistic, sometimes not so pluralistic environments. And I, as an outsider, but a very interested outsider who's observing Islam today, I find a lot of new voices and progressive voices surprising, given the kind of assault that Islam as an organic whole is feeling. I'm really gratified with the development given the situation, and I think it's going to increase. And the more voices there are, the more options there are, and the less control some more tyrannical voices have within the system. And I think we're moving. I sometimes think of me.
We adopted you a long time ago. So.
Honorary member.
Aren't you lucky? Yeah. Very lucky.
Yeah. Double whammy, right? Yeah. So, yeah. So let's take the next question. Yes, sir. One. Let's. If you wouldn't mind, let's take numbers. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Anybody else? 6. 6. Okay, we're on 6, and that's it for now. Let's see if we can get beyond that. Okay. Do you remember your numbers? Yes, there.
If I may answer the question you didn't answer, and then I'll ask a tough question. I brought up in a Confucianism and a Buddhism, and then I became a Christian. When I came to the United States, there's so much conflict. I believe in God in heaven, and when we die, we go to heaven. That's my belief. Now, when God up there, look down on earth, and I'm sure he's telling us, you're all my children, but you call me different name, Jehovah, Allah, God, and you worship me in a different way. And God will say, it's okay. All I want is that you get along peacefully, and believe me, truly believe me, you know? And then God will say, there's a land of Jerusalem, you call it Holy Land. It was Holy Land. But it was a bloodshed with the hatred and revenge and killing. And then you want us, you, me, God, or Jesus, come down there. No, we'll not come down. Now, clean this holy land, really holy land, with your tears of repentance, with the sweat of your hard work, cleanse this land, then we'll come down. And you have to get along peacefully. Now, that's my answer. Now, my question to you is, if there is a, let's say there's a three gods, Judaism, Muslim, Christian. There's a three different gods. Will they fight in heaven or one another? Tell us.
You bet they will.
Thank you.
And General Boykin already said our God is bigger than their God.
Well,
Is this a kind of Trinitarian question, or is this... yes.
I don't think there are too many... Well, I maybe take that. I was going to say that I don't think too many people would insist that their God is a separate God among these three religions. But there are some, indeed. I've met members of each religion who say, no, it's entirely different. But let me ask you the question the other way. If there was no Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, do we believe that people would be happy then and getting along perfectly well and there would be no quarrels? I mean, in the case of Palestine, we know that this originally had nothing to do with religion. We had Jews who were living in Western Europe and persecuted and finally underwent the Holocaust, who Europe felt guilty about it and encouraged them to move to Palestine. As we know, many hundreds of thousands of Palestinians lost their homes. It wasn't because the Palestinians were Muslim. Many were Christian, for that matter. But what if they had been Buddhist? They still would have lost their lands in the same process, and there would have still been the same degree of resentment. So I think if you take a religion out from this, you'll find, sadly, a question of ethnicity and territoriality with some reference to historical controls or ownership, but it's not really about religion at all. And that's one of the really open and shut cases, I think, of a quarrel that does not have a religious basis, unless you insist that it has a religious basis.
Thank you. Number two. Or three. Are we two or three? I don't remember.
I'm two.
You're two.
To anyone on the stage, what do you think of the wisdom and likelihood of an Israeli or American attack on Iran in the near future? Wanna?
CIA question. Ruben says it isn't a CIA question. It's the policymakers. I think CIA would actually be rather opposed to it, but that's not their job. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't say that with total certainty, but if somebody said you're putting your house and your family's income on a yes or no on that, I would say I don't think it's going to happen, simply because the consequences are pretty awful, and I think an awful lot of people know that. But very terrible decisions have been made in the past when it was also clear that the results. But yeah, short answer, no, I don't think it's going to happen.
Number three.
Four.
Oh, number four. Okay, number four.
Number four. Sufism impressed me as being a form of progressive Islam, but I was told by a certain imam that it wasn't real Islam.
Well, this is probably a question for Dr. Hatu to answer, but I would just say I think Sufism is one of the jewels of Islam. It is probably it's part of a mystical tradition that is embraced in deeply in Judaism, in Christianity, in Buddhism, in Hinduism. It's a glorious tradition, and it's certainly deeply rooted in Islam. Certainly, ultra-Orthodox Muslims might say that, no, it's too sloppy, but there are those in every religion who are more concerned with laws and what you can and cannot do than they are with the joy of human existence and the inspiration that we draw from God and God's creation in its fullness. So sure, you'll find people who will say it's not Islam, but I think most Muslims would feel in their hearts it's what brings them, among other things, joy.
Yeah, certainly. Sufism is not the same thing. It's not. There is no monolith called Sufism. There are different kinds and different ranges. But if we take the common denominator, it is trying to connect with God through spiritual elevation and exercise. And based on that definition, every Muslim is partially Sufi, because after all, the whole idea is to communicate with God, to be his agent, and to please him, and to believe only in him, etc. So from that perspective, it is a very commendable way to communicate with God. What happened historically when we came to on Earth here, we found like every good thing, it took different directions. Some of them were not easy to be digested by the general tenets of Islam. For example, and all of it was because of misunderstanding, not malice. For example, Hallaj, who is a great Sufi, he said, there is nothing inside this abaya, abaya is the cloak, but God. So on the surface, he's saying that he's God. And so it is heresy, the bad kind of heresy. And of course, at that time of dictatorship, he was chased and killed by the state. But if you look deeper, he was actually challenging the authority of the state. It's not that, who cares? You want to communicate with God whatever way, as long as you do it in your home. But he goes to the poor people, the downtrodden, the coalesce around him, and he leads them. So he becomes a dangerous person. Sayyid al-Badawi in Egypt, he was actually an active fighter against Napoleon and his invasion to Egypt and liberated the prisoners of war. So the authority and the orthodoxy authority, and let's call the spade a spade, the Wahhabi trend, feel that those are dangerous. And they don't say they are dangerous to us, they say they are a danger to the religion. Because the Sufi gives himself or herself the flexibility to, this way will bring me closer to God rather than what the Imam is telling me. Because it is very subjective, very individualistic, and cannot be concretized in a code. So the marriage between authority and the clergy did not feel comfortable with that, so they gave them bad name. However, definitely they even themselves called it Shatahat al-Sufiya, means when we go so far, when we are blown away so far, that he feels, you pray to be closer to God, I am already close to God, so I don't need to pray. You fast because you feel that this will make you spiritual, I am already spiritual. So it is a leeway to break away from the tenets under the rubric of I am connecting. If he is true, that's great. I mean, who am I to judge him? Because we don't know what is inside of people. But as one of them said, you keep saying, this person told me about this person, about this person, about the person that the Prophet said. This is a talk of a dead, about a dead, about a dead. But I tell you, my heart told me about God. This is the talk of a living, about the ever, always alive. So they have their logic, they have their zone of comfort. And as I said, every Muslim should have a small Sufi inside. Yeah.
Thank you. Where are we?
I think number 15 now.
I think we, yes.
Okay. I'm curious about oil.
How crude.
Yeah.
Oh.
Touché.
Dark humor.
Since it's not, if it's not about religion, and if it is about flexing, if you see the empire flexing its muscle, to what extent would you say that the U.S. interest in oil in the Middle East is at the root cause of its interest there, and to what extent do you see that playing out now, if at all?
Yeah, well, I feel that, I mean, the United States has talked for decades about protecting the free flow of oil. And then they would complain that Europeans, when the U.S. would bring around the cup for contributions from European states and say you have to contribute to our keeping our troops to preserve the free flow of oil, many European states said, thanks, but no thanks. We don't believe in the mission. We don't think that we need to protect the free flow of oil. And furthermore, we think that perhaps your military presence in the Gulf may be complicating the problem of the free flow of oil. So at this point, you know, when you look at every tin pot dictator or big dictator in the Middle East, Gaddafi or Saddam or in Iran, they've always happily sold oil to anybody that's come along. So I fear, as I've gotten older, I tend to believe that this has been a justification for expansion of military power for the sake of expansion of military power. Just as I tend to feel that the American military presence by now in Afghanistan has much more to do with having a monstrous air base in Bagram that is near the Chinese and Russian borders to check geopolitically these states forever, if you will, than it does really with Taliban and the rights of women. So I think, you know, the oil matters terribly, but the oil that going through the Persian Gulf is mostly going to Asia. The Chinese and the Indians and the Japanese and others have far more interest in that oil from the Middle East than we do. We get our oil from Canada or from Venezuela, mostly. So I think it's, I'm afraid at this point in my life, I think it's a red herring. I don't believe that that it's a mission that is self-imposed for other purposes. And if there is a terrible problem, then all right, we'll get Chinese troops or American troops or somebody's troops will get there pretty soon.
Okay, do we have any more left? I think we had at least one more in this round. I think we have one here. In all fairness, I think we need to go here and then the next one. So, yeah.
Hello. Early in your talk, you discussed East-West relations going back to the Persian and Greek empires, and you said you felt that there were really underlying tensions throughout history between East and West. I'd be interested in your defining what you mean by East and West, and I'd be interested in you telling us a bit more about what you think those underlying tensions were and whether this the same. We traveled in the Balkans about a year ago, and I certainly found it most fascinating to hear about the various perceptions as one moved from Roman Catholic areas in Croatia down to Albania and Macedonia and Bosnia and parts of the old, clearly part, yeah, the division between the old Ottoman Empire and not. But I'd like to hear what you have to say on it.
Well, that's a very good question and to the point. I mean, I want to give a very brief answer because time is short. But, I mean, East and West is all very relative. It's depending on where you are, what's East and West. So at the time, I'm simply saying that the Persian Empire and Greece were perhaps among the most powerful civilizations and in some degree of confrontation. By today's standards, it would all be mostly in the East. And then with the growth of Rome, emergence of Rome, the West shifted further west. And today, West has shifted way west, all the way to the United States. So I think they're highly relative terms, but yeah, I wouldn't want to say that it's a law of politics that great civilizations will clash, but there can be a greater degree of rivalry, and the more ignorant the leadership of these states are, the more they see this in terms of confrontation, such as the rise of Chinese power. Is this a terrible threat to the United States? And we have all kinds of people busy in Washington all the time writing threat assessments about the rise of China. Or is it possible to manage this relationship? It's a degree of sophistication and maturity, I would argue, of foreign policy, and not simply that we have an Eastern power and a Western power in itself.
Okay, so far I think we're at pretty much the last question, so it better be good.
No pressure. Okay. This is for Mr. Fuller, and this is more of a philosophical question. So as you were mentioning the different crusades, the Christian crusades, and like you said, many of us don't really know that much about it. I couldn't help but think of a chapter from the autobiography of a yogi, where Yogananda has just lost his beloved guru, and he's in a hotel room, and his guru appears to him. He manifests after death, and he talks about the next life, where he's from, and then he shows Yogananda, as if you were watching through a film, the entire history of humankind, of the wars and the oppressions and the bloodshed, etc., and goes on and on. So having had your perspective of writing about this and visiting certain periods in history and talking about the future and even about China, which we just mentioned, can you be optimistic? Is this about ultimately about human nature and not about religion at all? because it seems to me that even mentioning Marxism and so forth, which had nothing to do with religion, unless you want to call that communism a religion, it seems that there's a factor here that's just eternal in human life. And can you be an optimist after everything that you've learned?
Wow, well, that's an incredible question.
You did it.
Yes, she did. You did. She delivered. can I deliver, though? It's a long question, and obviously our time is now very short. But first of all, I would jump out and rashly venture, and to be corrected by my two distinguished colleagues, that maybe we have religion because of the human condition in part. That we need desperately some higher vision that will try to keep us away from our more ugly facets. Whether the world is getting better and better or worse and worse, I think people have struggled with this thought for a very long time. Certainly materially, there's no question. I mean, our children are not dying of diseases that they would have died from even 50 years ago. And this has to be good, and going to the dentist is a less agonizing process today than it would have been 50 years ago, or much less 100 or 500 years. So I think materially speaking, that's good, and maybe to the extent that wealth can be partially more experienced by others, or at least a better life, hopefully it may reduce some of these frictions. But I'm not really sure about this. I don't know whether... Science is accumulative knowledge, not wisdom. It's accumulative knowledge. But whether wisdom accumulates and whether we learn from our past, I don't know whether there's any kind of consensus on this at all. Some would say yes, and some would say no, and some would say it depends on what you're talking about in certain areas. I think we have to be optimistic, and we need to strive for enlightenment, and that enlightenment can come essentially in any religious tradition, especially a religious tradition, but even a secular enlightenment about the human condition, I think, is possible. So it's an individual task. Really, in the end, I think it's an individual task. It won't be states. I don't look to the state for much that's enlightened anywhere. But to the power of individuals to speak up and have a grander vision and a greater exposure to spiritualism now, no longer just within our tradition, but other traditions, as you've had, as I've had, and others of us have had. I think there is some hope that as individuals we can change the character of our societies, and indeed even the leadership, which may be lagging in many respects. So, great question.
So, thank you. I guess I get the organizers or the whatever MC's prerogative to have a last word. I want to thank everyone for coming. I very much appreciate your last remark. I think being hopeful is extremely important. We have this huge mass of knowledge, of information, of scientific development. What we need is hopeful people who are positive, who reach out to others across boundaries and across borders, so that we can bring a better sense of understanding. Everyone in this room is hereby been deputized to engage so that we can make this world a better world, and we can all work and live together in happiness and peace. One little piece of information. My publisher informed me that in these kinds of occasions, between 15 and 20% of the people actually purchase the book. It's not my book, but you really should buy it. I'd like to get those numbers up. So as we leave this forum, I invite you to take a look and to get a signed copy of the book. It's a good read. It's worth it. I want to thank Dr. Meyer Hatoot, Graham Fuller for coming, and all of you for coming as well. Thank you very much, and have a good evening.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Boujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.